I wanted to do in my talk was at least make a case where controlled environments are very pertinent, and that's for space, because by definition you need to have a controlled environment in space. Oops, how do I advance this? I click. There you go. Okay, well, why is anybody even interested in plants for space? And it's there are two reasons. An agency like NASA, and there are other space agencies around the world that have these interests. One is for fundamental research, looking at gravity responses, things like that. Another one is a more applied aspect, and that's using plants for life support. As we all know, plants through photosynthesis produce oxygen and remove CO2. Those are two functions that you need to consider on space missions. And if you choose the right kinds of plants, the biomass you get is edible. So if you grow crops, you can get a third life support function, and you can even co-utilize the transpiration process for water purification. So it's a nice fit. It's worked on Earth for millions of years, and potentially could work in space too. Oops, that thing didn't switch on me. Well, I'll do it since it's there. This is some of the crops that have been looked at over the years. These studies have been going since, maybe 1980 or so. So about 25 years worth of studies. A whole range of crops have been looked at for these kinds of applications. And I don't want to get into this any more beyond that, but just to show you that there's a wide variety. Well, as I mentioned, space systems for crops, by definition, must be controlled environments. You can't, if you go into space and you set up a life support system, and this would be future, not right away, not space station, not space shuttle, these kinds of things. But if you have a lunar base, you have to have a protected environment. It has to be pressurized, it has to be temperature controlled, it has to be shielded probably from radiation. You can't have things exposed to space. Living things just aren't going to make it. People talk about terraforming and things of that nature, but that's way off in the distance. So, well, what specific things? This is just my opinion here, some environmental considerations for space. The ones above the line, I'm saying, are similar considerations as they are for Earth. Things like temperature, humidity, air circulation, lighting. If you're in a growth chamber, you'd probably use electric lighting. If you're in a greenhouse or even in a space system, maybe there are ways to use direct solar lighting, and I'll mention some of that. And carbon dioxide is something you can control in these systems. So those are common issues, I think, both for terrestrial and space. You're going to hear more speakers that address some of these things specifically. Some of the more unique things, I think, because you're in a closed environment, the atmospheric composition, now you have a lot more leeway there in how you manage that environment. Things like CO2 partial pressure could be very elevated above what you might typically expect in closed systems, especially where you have humans breathing. And indeed, that's the case, and I'll show some data on that. The partial pressure of oxygen, you could manage that. Things that, because the systems are closed, you have to worry about volatile organic compounds. That's something that you typically don't have to deal with in the field, certainly, and even in controlled environments that are reasonably open. Pressure, we're going to hear specific talks about pressure. And of course, gravity is an issue. It depends where you go in space. Gravity is one thing that you don't have a lot of options for in terms of testing on Earth. We don't have any black boxes for gravity. We do for electromagnetic forces, but the gravitational force is something that goes through everything. So the only options you have there are you can go to drop towers, or you do these parabolic airplane flights, but you only get short durations of weightlessness, or even fractions of G. The only other option is you can go into space. I put clinostats there too. If you're familiar with some of the traditional literature on gravity studies, people have used clinostats. You put a plant on a horizontal axis and you rotate it. It's like putting it on a rotisserie. You don't negate gravity. You don't eliminate gravity, but you negate the directional influence. So it's a little bit of a different thing. And then radiation is another big issue. Oops. Okay, well, what are some observations from, and I'll mention NASA-sponsored studies, but I just want to point out there are other space agencies around the world that have had interest in this. A lot of the studies that have been done, and these are were largely in the 1980s and 90s university-based efforts on NASA grants, used recirculating hydroponic systems. This is just a matter of convenience in these controlled environment studies. Because, again, it's a closed system, you can't do one-pass watering, you have to recirculate everything. And economically, you want to conserve your water and your nutrients. There's nothing new about hydroponics. It's been around 60 or 70 years, but the different application here was using this approach for a production kind of emphasis instead of just fundamental studies on mineral nutrition and so forth. So you see some examples there, some of Bruce Bugbee's work there with wheat, some of our studies with soybean, Tuskegee University with sweet potato, rice at Purdue. And from these studies, there were some very interesting findings, and one of these was if you could push the lighting with electric lighting, and you can extend photo periods, you can go up in the PAR levels, you can enrich with CO2, you can get some pretty remarkable yields in controlled environments if you measure things properly. And that's a tricky thing to do, believe it or not, is to get accurate yield measurements in growth chambers. In my opinion, a lot of people make a lot of mistakes there. You have side lighting things and so forth. But Bruce Bugbee's group at Utah State has gotten remarkable yields with wheat where you push it with high light, 3 to 4 times world records. Ted Tibbetts and I, with our potato studies in Wisconsin, we got the equivalent of 200 metric tons per hectare of potatoes. That's about, if you think in the potato vernacular, that's about 1,800 hundredweight per acre. You know, potato people have their versions. But point being, you can get very high yields. A lot of these systems also were conducive to getting direct canopy gas exchange measurements. Now I'm going to talk about closed systems because that's where my experience has been, but you can approach this in several ways. You can make these measurements in open systems, and I think Mark Van Ursel is going to talk some about that today too. But closed systems, and you see examples there, NASA's Ames Research Center, Purdue University, Johnson Space Center, and then our group at Kennedy Space Center down there in the corner. And I'll show you, specifically the chamber we use for that. This is a big growth chamber. It was it's a two-story high cylindrical vessel that provided about 20 square meters of growing area, had an internal volume of 113 cubic meters, and had 96 400 watt high-pressure sodium lamps in there. So that means you have 96 400 watt heaters going inside a steel tank. So you have to move the air around 400 cubic meters per minute with two big fans and 52 kilowatts chilling and so forth. So it's pretty brutal in terms of the energy. But it was a good system to do plant studies in closed environments. This is just an example of some soybeans in there. This shows two shelves. There's another story below this with two more shelves in kind of a circular geometry there. And if you track things like gas exchange in this closed system, you'll see something like this with a full canopy. This is soybeans, and you notice that this shows a 12-hour photo period here. During the dark cycle, the CO2 concentration goes up, just as you'd expect from respiration, canopy respiration. Lights come on, it draws down to a set point where you engage a control system and you start shooting in CO2. And we were holding 1,000 ppm there as our set point. Lights go out, up again, down, and so forth. And so you can use those natural rise and fall slopes and calculate the canopy respiration and photosynthetic rates as a closed system approach. Or you could look at that set point control and use a null balance, a semi-closed system approach to measure gas exchange that way too. Of course, oxygen then is doing the opposite. It goes up in the light, comes down a little in the light, or dark, up, and so forth, and you keep going up and actually, then you have to worry about fire hazard conditions in closed chambers, kind of an interesting thing. Another nice aspect of a closed system is that you can shut off the CO2 supply and just let the CO2 draw down from photosynthesis to a compensation point. Now, this is a pretty stressful thing to do to a plant canopy, to have them choking away without any CO2 and under high light. But you then just transform that whole curve, and you have now a full CO2 response over, or a photosynthetic response over a range of CO2. This makes a lot of assumptions that your stomates and your system is adjusting as the CO2 changes, but we have some pretty good measurements to indicate that this is a reasonably good way to get a quick measurement of CO2 responses in pool canopies. And then you see a very typical response like that. Good C3, that's for wheat. Another thing, because these are closed systems, you can monitor volatile organic compounds, things like ethylene gas. We all know plants make ethylene. And what we didn't know is how much they really made in these systems. And a lot of it occurs during vegetative growth. If you look at these graphs here, there's four species, wheat, soybean, lettuce. And then this just shows the ethylene concentration inside that large chamber over time. It doesn't keep going up continuously because the chamber does leak. So at any one point, the concentration is sort of an equilibrium point between the leakage and what the plant canopy is producing. But you see that it goes up very rapidly during rapid growth, and then you can track the biomass and divide that concentration by the biomass. And you see that actually the highest production rates are when the canopies are very young and growing rapidly. And this surprised us. We thought ethylene would go up when they're expiring and senescing and going out, but that wasn't the case. With a few notable exceptions, when you get into fruit-producing crops that go through climacteric respiration and ripening events, like tomato, then ethylene goes way up. In our studies, tomatoes won the ethylene derby hands down. I mean, it just goes way up during them. That's a little hard to see, isn't it? Sorry about that, those dark lines here. Another interesting thing that we noticed is that, as I mentioned, in closed systems for space, you might be stuck with peculiar situations where CO2 gets very high. And so if you look at responses to super elevated CO2, we saw some very interesting things in terms of stomatal conductance. And here's 1,000, and if you go to 400, the conductance is higher. You see kind of a diurnal rhythm here. But if you go to the super elevated, the stomates actually open back up. And they don't close down much at night. And this is something that I wish the stomatal gurus would pick up on. I think this would be very informative in terms of finding out more about stomatal mechanisms. Anyway, so you have to worry about things like that. Okay, some other things that are peculiar to controlled environments versus field that are important to know for space, and physiological disorders, things like leaf tip burn. This is a calcium deficiency thing. A lot of people that grow lettuce in controlled environments see this. And the lettuce plants are just outstripping their calcium supply. You could grow them on crushed limestone and you'd still get this. They just can't get it to the young leaves in the head quick enough. If you go to long photo periods, you can confuse plants. Their nyctinastic movements get all screwed up, and things like potatoes, all the leaves are up in the air under a long photo period like that. You can get these epidermal disorders, oedema and intumescence. This is a light spectral related thing. If you don't have UV in the spectrum, you can get this, solanaceous plants especially. And even in those super elevated CO2, we saw this bleaching injury. How am I doing on time, Oscar? Okay, good. Okay, yeah, give me a warning here. I might get overzealous in my approach here. In controlled environments, you have to think about electric lighting. This is one of the options clearly for space. And I see that Bruce Bugbee's going to address this later in his talk, so I'm not going to dwell on this much. But you see there's different lamps you can think about. And for space, you have to think about the economics of it. What are their electrical efficiencies, what are their operating life, and they have different spectral things, and so that's a consideration to bear in mind. One thing that's getting to be popular now, they're still quite expensive, are light-emitting diodes for growth chambers. Gives you a lot of options in terms of composing a spectrum, and they last a long time, and they're getting more efficient all the time, and they're kind of neat things to think about. This is a growth chamber that we Well, for space, you could use electric lighting. Maybe you could use direct solar lighting. This shows a concept that Phil Sadler, University of Arizona, drew up where he's talking about inflatable greenhouse-like structures where you maybe have the right materials that are somewhat transparent. You inflate them to a certain pressure, you grow plants in them directly on the surface. This makes a lot of assumptions that you have very durable materials that can hold pressure, can withstand UV radiation, and hold up under the rigors of space. So that's, or maybe you could even bury them. Is that 5 minutes? A couple minutes? Okay. Like this to protect from radiation where you have solar collectors and you bring it in under fiber optics. We're going to hear more about pressure. Pressure is an interesting aspect of the environment. Mike Dixon's going to talk some more about that. There are some physical principles, though, that are affected by pressure. Things like saturation pressure in water does not change as you go down in pressure. It's independent of total pressure. But evaporation rates go up. So there's some interesting things you got to worry about there. Okay, what are my conclusions? Controlled environments are clearly appropriate for space applications with plants, and space environments, by definition, must be controlled. Many factors are similar to terrestrial factors or concerns, things like temperature and humidity. Other factors are unique and will require special capabilities, things like pressure, oxygen, partial pressure. Yet others are probably require space studies to fully understand their effects, things like gravity and the combination of radiation, high-energy radiation particles, and so forth. And I think controlled environments are also appropriate for applications, terrestrial applications of controlled environment agriculture. Are controlled environments appropriate to extend to field settings? I know there's a lot of discussion lately in the literature about this, and let me give you my last slide, just one example here, where these are NASA-sponsored studies with potatoes. Ted Tibbetts and I did these studies in the mid-1980s, and we did CO2 enrichment with potatoes in growth chambers, and we found about 39% increase in yield when we went to 1,000 ppm. You see these varieties here. That's the light we use, and if we increase the light, the advantage of CO2 enrichment dropped a little bit, 29%. So I went in the literature and compared these with some face studies done in Europe, and they were enriching to only 660, but they got about a 40% increase in yield in one study, and a 32% increase when they went to 550. This was at a different variety. So my interpretation of this is that, you know, you got a 39 here, a 29 there, a 32, and a 40. Those numbers are reasonably close in my interpretation. So I would suggest that if you do controlled environment studies and take the proper precautions, I guess, interpreting the data, that they could be meaningful in terms of understanding field responses. So I'll end it there, and if I'll field any questions if you have.
We got 2 minutes for questions.